This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
It's a great pleasure to welcome you to this reading that Lori Lemoine will be doing tonight. Before I actually start the introduction, I'd like to read the mission statement for Cavan Carey, which is the publisher that has been publishing Lori's work. Through publishing and programming, Cavan Carey Press connects communities of writers with communities of readers. We publish poetry that reaches from the page to include the reader by the finest new and established contemporary writers. Our programming brings our books and our poets to people where they live, cultivating new audiences and nourishing established ones. It's really hard to do an introduction for a friend. I've known Lori as long as I've been here, right? Lori's been here for longer than I have, which means that she's been here for almost 25 years. That's amazing. Lori received her bachelor's from Whitworth, from this very department, her MFA from the University of Montana, where she worked with Dick Hugo, her PhD from the University of Utah, where she worked with Mark Strand. As I said, she's been teaching here for nearly 25 years. And this is another thing that I'm incredibly proud of. She started as an adjunct, and she's now a full professor. Lori has won the Pushcart Prize, the Graves Award, the Washington State Artist Trust Fellowship, and the prestigious Witterbinner Fellowship. She has shared her poetry and read at the 20th anniversary of the Washington State Artist Trust Foundation celebration, the Seattle Public Library, and finally at the Library of Congress. She's been published in such journals as the Seattle Review, the Southern Humanities Review, Primavera, Feminist Studies, Arts and Letters Journal of Contemporary Culture, Plowshares, New Republic, and the Atlantic Monthly. She's been anthologized in 3 books, including Billy Collins's 180 More Extraordinary Poems for Ordinary Days. She has 2 books that have been published by Cavan Carey Press, the first called The Fork Without Hunger and the second Without Wings. These books are available in the lobby, and they will be for sale afterward. And if they run out, you can the bookstore is ordering more. As I said, it's hard to do an introduction for a friend, but I was looking through one of her last book of poetry, and I identified a poem that I really, really love. And the poem is called Reading the Poem, fittingly enough. But before I read just a little part of it, because I know you want to hear Lori and not me, I have to show you that I've done a little bit of research. So the final words of the poem happen to be the word irises. And as you know, irises are the flower, right? What other kinds of irises are there? Come on. Okay, the diaphragm in your eye, and there are more irises. There's a color. It also means, and this is according to the dictionary, an iris can also be a rainbow. And the iris is also the Greek goddess of rainbows and one of the messengers of the gods. So this poem ends on a wonderful, wonderful pun. And I think this is a testimony to her absolutely wonderful and exquisite artistry and her technical excellence. I'm just going to read the last stanza, but it's called Reading the Poem.
Read the whole poem, Doug.
No, yeah, I can't
read
do
the whole poem.
No, I can't do that. It is a faux pas for introducers to read complete poems. I just think it's wrong. It's morally wrong. Okay. So I'm just going to read the last stanza. It begins, the poem begins ostensibly talking about flowers, okay, or gardening, right? Am I wrong? Okay, good.
Whatever you want it to be.
Anyway, the last stanza goes, reading the poem, instant light, instant water, consonants, irises, irises. Pretty cool, eh? Lori Lamont.
Thank you, Doug, for... Actually, I didn't put that on the list to read, so I'm looking up the page number. Or maybe I should just not read it, so you have to buy the book to find out if the rest of the poem is any better than that last stanza. Okay, well, thank you so much for being here. This is just such a pleasure to look out and see friends and family and students, and those terms sort of blur into each other as we get to know each other over the years. So colleagues are here. I've got family here tonight. So it really means a lot. And Doug, thank you for that really lovely introduction. My poetry life has been intertwined with a lot of people in this community for many, many years. And I just printed a poem earlier this year about shoes, talking about, the poem starts with the image of a girl trying on her first toe shoes, which happened to be Doug's daughter, Julie. I remember she showed me her shoes when I was in their kitchen one night. And then the poem ends with an image of being at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and seeing that exhibit of shoes. And the poem came from something Doug said to me. He said, if they started with the shoes, nobody would ever finish the exhibit. But the shoes are midway through because it's so devastating. The shoes of all these Jews who've lost their lives. I'm in a room full of shoes. So a lot of poems have been tested out in friends' homes and students' classes and all of that. So thank you for being such an important part of that. I thought I would start with a poem. I actually read this in Vic's class on Wednesday, but it's a poem that I like to start with, and I was thinking actually about this reading tonight, thinking we were just here last Friday for David Daniels, and I feel like his big personality and beautiful presence is sort of still here. Some of those poems that he read were big poems, and most of what you will hear tonight from me are pretty small poems, just kind of looking at things really, really closely. This is a little bit longer. It's about a page and two-thirds. And it starts with, it's called To Know. And it starts with the dictionary from Webster's. I mean, we all think we know what all words mean, right, that we use. We all know what to know means, don't we? Well, when I looked it up, from Webster's, the definition is to recognize as being the same as something previously known. And I thought, wait a minute, that sounds like memory. Or recall. So right away, you know, we're sort of in a fuzzy place. And so the poem is a collection of things that I didn't know and wanted to know about, in part. I didn't know how many miles we are from the Earth's center, 3,000 miles, or the diameter of the Earth's core, three-fourths that of the moon, or that every 400 years the Earth's inner core is a full turn ahead of the surface where I am reading in bed, upright as a coin spun on a table, an illustration of goodwill between acceleration and gravity, whose laws have landed us here on a mattress resting above an aged hardwood floor. The edges of oak drift and touch like fold or tear faults we silence occasionally with nails driven up from the basement, where coolness has collected for years, like the heart's faith and doubt. Beyond the window, bees are drawn to the rhododendron and coreopsis, hues we cannot see, nor the mouth part sensitive to heat, nor the feathery leg hairs rattled with pollen. To tell where more food is, they dance in the hive. What sways with ripeness, they find by knowing light's immeasurable season. For them, sweetness offered like strokes of luck. Light we don't know how to know finds us. Mornings before we are fully awake, when you draw my leg across you and cup my foot, and then the ankle bone, your fingers circle as though it were a city on a map. Or evening, when we watch the bird coming, not for water, closer. I'm going to go back and forth between Without Wings and a few poems from The Fork Without Hunger, and then a couple of new poems. This is a little poem called Something Else. And some of these poems don't need anything said about them. But I was listening to crickets. And you know, when you hear a cricket sound, there's that sort of double note and there's that little notch in between. And I was trying to hear that, just really listen to it and just kind of separate out, what does that sound like? Because it's so fast, even though the sort of pulse of it is slow, but that one little note is really fast. Something else. This hour I should be working, not here, not listening to the crickets who stopped and began again, thrilling the second I thought how I would like to discover, but cannot surely, what must be silver and heavy. That tiny throb notching each note a split second, like a breath or something else caught by love, indrawn, involuntary. And then another little new poem. I've been working on this for a really long time, but it's new as a poem. It's called Evening Walk. When we moved apart on the path, the dog straining, wanting the scent of animal tracks on snow, shoe prints in the fountain bed of snow, you didn't hear the bird that flew just past my shoulder, whir and luster, cutting into a hedge's astral dark. How to speak such a sound? Like an envelope torn open, or one millennia passing to the next. Some of these poems that I'm going to read, I have a kind of arc to the reading, so we're going to go to some more serious poems and sort of political poems, and then I'll close with some love poems. But this is called The Beginning and the End. What do we make of the god of vengeance, the bloodshed of kings, the women running from homes without preparation? What do we make at the end of astonishment's glance, without preparation for darkness, and afterward, darkness? What do we make of the landscape where stone begat stone, where soil was lifted and carried, and the cell's transparency was lifted and carried? What do we make of the feathers, the imprint of glass, the black weather swept into floorboards? What do we make of the 27 bones of the hand, the clod of dirt, the ring? What do we make of the sun replacing his meals with morning? And that's M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. What do we make of the sun replacing his meals with morning, his evening run and the hour of bedtime reading with morning? What do we make of a father's wristwatch, a hospital window, sun splintered? What do we make of the driver's license and telephone number, the heart's empty quarter, the history of voices, birthplace and geography, the blurred eye, the shoelace pulled from the shoe? This poem is called Trash. I'm sure you all have heard about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in Poland during the war. It was an effort by the Jews to fight back against Nazi Germany's efforts to transport the remaining population to Treblinka, a concentration camp. And the Jews in the ghetto launched this uprising on January 18, 1943. The most significant part of it took place April 19th to May 16th, 1943, which is a long time when you know they had literally nothing to fight with. So it was the single largest revolt of Jews during the Holocaust. Trash. Hide, you said. And I should say at the opening of the poem, this is my husband speaking to me, okay? And then the poem moves. Trash. Hide, you said, and pulled the sheet over my face. They're taking our trash to Never Never Land. I was still hearing the language of day's unlikeness, language of just before sleep and waking, the language of clothes taken off and found afterward. Daylight, not yet historical. Cause and effect gone underground. Never, never land. The truck stopping. Hide, you said, and pulled the sheet over my face. I've never told you this. While we were laying together, the truck still a block away, I'd been thinking about a ghetto. City within a city, where nothing was left over, thrown away, where nothing was refuse. No trash at curbside. No newspapers, flower stems bent like nails, no cartons clouded with milk, no stacked cardboard left out. What did they hear, hearing the trucks stop? City within a city, entrance and departure, the thousands of places a bullet can enter the body. Look how far you've come. I gave you a tree, and you said tree, and then cut and cut until you were hoarse with calling back the rings, back the branches. I gave you wind, and you thought it was a box, a sheet, something to cart away all you had burned. I gave you land, and you dug a pit, a canal. You dug stone from a quarry, and now look. Look at the statues, one by one, how they resemble you. I asked my class last spring to write a villanelle, and I thought, well, I have to write one too. If I'm going to ask them to write a villanelle, I'm going to write a villanelle. They wrote theirs a lot faster than I did. I had to give myself an extra month because I write really, really slowly, and sometimes a poem will take years. But we all agreed we would just write a bad villanelle, just learn from the experience. And they were amazing. I couldn't believe it. My students' poems were just amazing. And I ended up writing two. So this is called Walking the Dog in the Dark. And the word pale, there's an image of pale of leaves, and it means pale, meaning a geographical location, okay? So a villanelle has repeating lines and a rhyme scheme, okay? They're a really good poem form for poems of loss or obsession because of that repetition, okay? And they're just really fun. It's a really graceful, beautiful form. So this is about walking my dog. Walking the Dog in the Dark. What rustles is wider in the dark than the rout of animals or pail of leaves. In the dark, we're missing while we walk, seeing then losing the gray chalked moon. Full, it retreats like an ache or fever. What remains of ache is wider than dark. I think of my father. I told my mistakes to his headstone, its 25th year. I had turned 50. In the dark, we're missing while we walk. The dog pulls at the end of her lead, taking the scent of fur, wind without ease. Copper leaves rustle in the places of dark. Leaves falling multiply leaves. A solo birch is a blank verse between moon and empty street. In the dark, we're missing while we walk. At the end of the moon, there is another arc, another hour. Walking, I think of being no one's daughter. What rustles is wide in the dark. In the dark, we're missing as we walk. Okay, I don't have any funny poems. I really don't. I tried to write one called I Don't Have Any Funny Poems, and it's got Woody Allen in it, so I'm hopeful. You know, have you all seen Manhattan? Have any of you seen Manhattan? You know the little scene where they're sitting by the bridge, and it's all lit up, and it's dark, and they've just had something to eat, and there's a little dog in that scene that's kind of wandering around. So that's as far as I've got. I'm working with that. But I thought I would read sort of a stand-in for a funny poem. And I have two of them. I'll read the first one first. This is, I mean, I'm taking a big risk here, okay? But some of you know that I like slugs. That's all I'm going to say. Okay, this poem is in two-line stanzas and it rhymes. Okay. It's called Slug. I don't want to give it salt or beer. I've seen them mate. The milk blue sex they loose and twine like wings that lift and fall in one slow place. It takes an animal faith to leave dirt's quiet fruited air for branch and wind's meteoric stir. Do you remember the faculty awards we got 2 years ago? Our little certificates? Do you remember those? Or was that 3 years ago? Fred, I know you have yours on your wall. Or is it Casey? You have... Okay. That was... Okay. All right. The second one is called Pain Thinks of the Star-Nosed Mole. And some of you know that I've done a series of poems using pain as a persona. So in the poems about family or religion or history or math or whatever I'm talking about, some of these are spoken through that sort of double or doppelganger. And I was working on another poem for a long time that had this image of a star-nosed mole, and I did a lot of reading and a lot of research about star-nosed moles, and they're just fascinating. Do you know what they look like? No? They're a mole. But they have this appendage on, it's their nose, and it's shaped like a star. There's 12, looks like kind of like a starfish with 12 legs. So you can either think, oh, that's disgusting, or you can think, it's fascinating. You have a star on your nose. And they're much more sensitive than an elephant's nose or trunk, which is incredibly more sensitive than a human nose. They're just an amazing creature in terms of what they can smell. So anyway, this is, I don't think this is a funny poem, but it's, I'm sort of having fun with this subject. Pain thinks of the star-nosed mole, and soberly, pain thinks of the slow star, the root and noun, the bell and drum, nudge of clod and mud, magnitude and murmur, end to end. pain thinks of magnitude, a thought, a turn, oh, slow star descending. I'm going to read another pain poem. This is called Pain Thinks of a Window. There's an epigraph that reads, it's from Psalms 36:9. In thy light shall we see light. And don't try to follow a story here. Think of this as a sort of, it's not really a prayer. Well, I'll let you think about what it is. Pain thinks of a window. If light, if a season of light, if dark, if a season, pain thinks of a threshold, a psalm of return, the coat worn a single night. Pain thinks of a window, an orchard, and wreaths of smoke and sugar. If harvest and grain, if light, if a season. Pain thinks of a window, if peace, if resistance. Apotheosis for the living, a chime for the living. The coat worn a single night. For the dead, a handrail, and familiar the infinite wood. Pain thinks of a window, a psalm, an anonymous this season, and torn the place of departure. This is called Pain Thinks of the Deaf Dog, the Subject. And my husband and I were in Petco a while back, and there was a man with a dog, and you know, you want to go up and say hello and pet the dog, and we're big dog lovers. And he said, no, don't touch it. He said, it's been beaten. He had rescued it and was sort of rehabilitating it. And this is kind of using that, but it's also doing something else. And there's two words that you will hear that you might not know the meaning of. The first is photogen, and it means one of the smallest part of speech that separates it from another sound. So S and P are two different sounds there. And the second one, is that right? No, the photogen is an after image. So if you look at something for a long time and then look away and close your eyes, you still see it. Did you ever do that when you were kids? Yeah. So, and then the phoneme is the smallest part of speech. So those two words are in the poem. Pain thinks of the deaf dog, the subject, wants to touch the dog beaten nearly to death. The gaze, the mouth tunnel it fled. Pain thinks of the photogen, the deaf dog, the blue and white eye. In the dream, the subject asks, is benevolence a word? The hand traveling the stilled back and skull coat tight as breath. Pain thinks of the deaf dog, the subject, word and phoneme, stick harness, it is a word. Pain thinks of the subject trained, the body trained, the gaze open and closed, the words current and shudder. Pain thinks of the deaf dog, the subject. Pain thinks of the blue, the white eye. This is a poem I don't usually read at readings. It's from The Fork Without Hunger. It's called Killing the Dog. It's kind of a, it's a poem that I wrote after Bill and I had to put to sleep our 11-month-old dog, Hanshan, after he had struggled for 11 months. He was a puppy mill puppy and was really sick. And his brother, Lipo, lived to be 12. We just lost him about a year and a half ago, or 2 years now, actually. And I think I was feeling like, is it okay to write poems where you're mourning an animal this much? You know? So that's what this is about. And there's a reference to a woman, the dying woman, who is Jane Kenyon, who died of cancer. And I actually sent a draft of this poem to Don and said, is it okay if I put Jane in this poem? And he said, yes. So, Killing the Dog. One, I bathe and brush the dog, knowing that by 5 p.m. he'll be put down. The kitchen window's shine confirms the little we know of dying. The dog settles into my arms and we lean back, watching the leaves of the flame willow burn, the perishable spring sap rising. Two, this is not the worst that can happen. I am not the mother or father who attends a daughter's grave each day in good weather, carrying the toy, the lawn chair, the book and coffee cup across green slopes and white stone markers. This is not the worst that can happen. I am not the dying woman who is asked for music to be turned off, flowers to be carried from the room. Three. I would have shown you a riverbank, a horse grazing, a river. You would have believed summer, then autumn. You would have believed a tree's rings could open white as smoke after the tree had been felled and cut for the next season, and then carried into a room where a fire burns and someone is reading or thinking of bed where the husband or wife is already asleep. Your meager shape would have warmed them until they returned to each other in the morning, laying together for a moment before rising and placing their feet on each cold side of the bed. This next poem is for Nadine and all of us who knew her and loved her. It's called Autumn Equinox. My friend's husband and I met once at the restaurant where they had come after work for sandwiches and drinks. Whiskey for him, for her a glass of wine. At her memorial service, the cantor's voice was so beautiful, I kept the communion wafer in my hand and folded the program's single sheet into a shape that might stay aloft. Again this year in Porchlight, I find pots of flowers on their sides, heavy with new growth, the clay rims scattering flakes and dark swarms of insects frantic on the brick when I set them back. We need to pull up the tomatoes, I tell my husband. We need to drain the fountain, and this watering, I'm done watering in the dark. Shift in tone. This is a poem that I wrote for the first niece or nephew in my family who got married. My brother Carl's son and Annette's son Luke got married last August. And I thought, I'm going to try to write a poem for them just to slip in their wedding card. And didn't tell anybody in case it didn't work out and, you know, or it was really bad and I didn't want to give it to them. So I wrote this for them, for Luke and Jana, and I ended up reading it at their wedding, which was a real honor for me. It's called When You Say Yes. When you say yes, let it be on a Thursday or a Sunday evening between the hours of 6 and 8, or in the morning when children are standing on street corners waiting for a bus, and the young ones are held by the hand and the older ones are holding hands for the first time. Let there be a man walking past in a blue windbreaker, and let the dog pulling at her lead be at the beginning of her life. When you say yes, let it be on a Monday or a Friday, and let there be candles at the edge of a pier and couples dancing. Let there be old and new green along the river, where you slow to watch for the heron who sometimes is there. And because of a sound or a glimpse of your faces, let it lift its long body, slowly, at an angle, the legs lingering at first until the wings catch the air. This is a new poem called Love. Love has never spoken for itself. We make it talk and breathe, behold, hold. I say the eye loves the eye. I say the breast wants a mouth to make a home of it. What else can mean mortality? And what of us? I'm getting on with years. Sometimes I say it when I watch you sleep, and the word is like a hive without our hands and veil and smoke. This is called Pain Thinks of the Hand, and it's in syllabic, so every line has 8 syllables. Pain thinks of the hand. Pain thinks of the hand without soil, without light, without thumb or ash, without food. Pain thinks of the hand without weight, without blossom or snow, without psalm. Pain thinks of blossom and psalm, without day and night, without translucence. Pain thinks of the hand without clothes, the pale cup, the body's deluge. This poem is called Instruction. And just to set it up a little bit, Bill and I had been working in the yard, and I guess that's all I need to say about it. We were working in the yard, and then he said this thing to me. And it was just the most amazing experience. So I don't want to give it away, because there's kind of a surprise at the end of the poem, just like there was a surprise for me. At the end, I'll make sure you understand what's happened, okay, in case the poem isn't clear enough. Because it kind of wanders out and then sort of comes back. Instruction. I moved to the place in the garden where we had been working and waited. And there's some dialogue in the poem. A foot to the left, back a step, now another. As in the child's game of surprise, blindfolds. As in the adult game of temporary forgiveness. Close your eyes. What do you hear, feel? What weight against your palm? What do you think it is? Presence, like matter's gravity, a boundary's weightlessness, balance as if counterpoise, as if the hand's own summoning, come closer, as if waves, close your eyes. And a child crouched behind the blue cardboard, slowly moving across a boundary stage, seeing the adult world through the eye hole, slowly, look up, where the sky is complete illusion, and the shape of a tree is a dome, silver green. The convex curves trick of light, light's continuous motion. As though the tree were not between seeing and the plenitude of will attenuated to this recognition. It was grass and root knuckled against branches, and then the dun underside of feathers, a pale bloodshot beak and the eye ringed with dust, the body held against the sky. Look up, what do you see? That it was brightness given without falling, without separation. We had been working in this little plot of our garden where there's a tree that's with kind of low branches. And Bill said, you know, stand up, take a step here, take a step back, no, over this way. And it kind of went on for a while. And then he said, look up. And I did, and I was right under a robin's nest. We had been working there the whole time, and I hadn't seen it, but he had. And I was so close to it, I could have touched it. So, two more poems, two love poems, and then we'll stop. I read this one in Vic's class, so you'll hear this again, and the introduction to it. But those of you who are writers know that you keep paper and pen beside your bed because you might think of something, and if you don't have paper and pen, you'll forget it, even if you think you won't forget it. So this is about the one that got away. Forgetting the water poem, and the poem sort of tells you why it got away. I didn't want to wake you. I had already gotten up from bed once for something I wanted to remember. I had been holding your arm in the crook of my arm. Your sleep was shallow. You were not dreaming. Your face was like the face of a child who was reading or looking at a watch. And the dog was asleep beside us on the bed we had made, where you could reach down and touch him with your fingers when he yelped and ran in the dream of running. There is nothing I remember of the water poem I wanted to keep, while the nothing of forgetting widened and darkness was what it was. You were sleeping. I didn't want to wake you. In the morning, we saw that it had snowed. The view was a vast whiteness narrowed by trees and yards. The night glasses of water, when I poured them out, were full and cold. We had not touched them to our mouths. We had not left fingerprints. This is called Bird Call Wave. And this was sort of triggered by a time that we were at the coast. And there was a bird that came right outside our window and sang to us every morning. It was just amazing, this beautiful little gift, just this little songbird out there singing away. But it came at 4 o'clock. And we started to call it the 4 o'clock bird, which, as we said, we would have preferred it to be, you know, the 8 o'clock bird. But you take what you're given, right? Bird call wave. Wife, my husband said. Husband. The ocean through the shades, motion and light. The near call of the bird we had begun to call the 4 o'clock bird. Then something else when I opened my hand and turned to the window side of the bed where he had moved, having drawn the sheet cold and welcome across my shoulders. Better to hear the waves. Better the bird's cry, released the way a spondee's struck sound is meant to be given and given. Not sweat and mouth. Not the orchid farmed and cut. No sound but the bird and the sea, and no bird alone but eye to eye. And then the praise that was the sea, and then the wings. Thank you. So what do you want to do now? Well, sometimes people have questions afterwards, and you know, I don't care. We can just go have cookies and punch, or if some of you have questions, whatever, I'm open. Yeah.
Do you find any particular way, like writing your poems, like whether it's handwritten or on the computer, works better? Or does it just depend?
It kind of depends on what stage it's at and where I am. I mean, sometimes they start on a piece of paper beside my bed. Sometimes they start when I'm in my office at work. Sometimes they start when I'm driving home from school. They just start. And then once they start, I usually take what I've jotted down and go to the computer because I can type faster than I can write by hand. But I carry them around. So I sort of go back and forth between typing, you know, adding things, typing, looking, seeing how it looks. Yeah. Sort of depends on poem to poem. Yes. This is our Oprah.
Do you still write the pain poems, or are those?
You know,
older?
That's, yeah. There's 12 pain poems in Without Wings, and I think there's 12 in the first book, and there's a collection of about 45 that I've put together in a single volume. But you can tell listening to them, they're very dense, and some of them are they're more complex than some of the other poems. They're slowing down. Pain thinks of The Star Knows Mole is the last one that I've written so far. I've got a couple that I'm still working on. But I'm doing some other things instead. I've gotten kind of obsessed with villanelles and sonnets. I mean, everyone's writing sonnets, but I've kind of moved over to that. So
I'm curious how, if you write in a persona and you continue to write in that persona over years and mm-hmm. years, if you find that that voice changes, or that it's, you just, you go to write and you know sort of that you have a poem in that voice.
The poems are really different. Some of them are very, there's a lot of research in them. I mean, I didn't read those tonight because I think they're sort of read better on the page. Others are smaller and more lyrical. They're about art. So I think the voice is really different from pain poem to pain poem. There are some similarities in clusters there, but I think they're pretty different. And they nudge me in my development as a writer, and I think my development as a writer has nudged them. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Sure.
Okay. Carl.
Lori,
this is my brother, by the way.
When are you going to plant your tomatoes so I know when to plant mine?
I know. Okay, I have to defer to Bill. Bill, when are we planting tomatoes? Soon. It was 74 today. So, but first we have to get our water turned on and get our sprinkler system turned on. My husband has been working ridiculous hours, so yeah, good question. Probably the most important question of the hour. Seriously. And there's a trick to it. You know, on the South Hill, you've got to get to Liberty Park Florist fast before everyone else buys up all the good ones. Any other non-tomato questions? Payne thinks of the tomato. Yes. Jacob?
How many poems, if any, do you end up discarding?
That's a good question. You mean for a collection? Or just generally?
Just like when you're writing that you decide you don't really like it, or you wouldn't want to show it to other people, or...
That's a good question. I mean, that's a question I could turn around and ask you, the other writers in the group. I think because I work on poems for so long, I mean, it's that I don't discard poems. There are poems that I think are less interesting that don't end up in a book, or I wouldn't read them at a reading, but they're part of the journey, you know, and I have, you know, collections of those. But I don't know, that's a really interesting question. I don't give up on poems. I might take just a little piece out of it, and then the rest, you know, is sort of put aside. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else? Yes, Lindsay.
How do you know when your poems are finished?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. These are good questions. Well, I mean, at some point I just have to trust myself. You know, I'm a very hard critic on myself. I sort of put my poems through my own meat grinder. And I mean, those of you who are writers know when you've got it, and you know when you've written past it. So I think part of it is just I've been doing this for a really long time, and it is like anything else. I think it's also really mysterious, some of it. Some of it's just hard work, and some of it is mysterious. But I always look for where is sort of the moment of most energy in a poem, and I don't want to write beyond that because that diffuses it. So part of it's instinct, part of it's just, you know, having written a lot of poems. Does that answer your question? Yeah. How do you know?
I haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, Diana.
What is your favorite part of teaching?
Oh, my favorite part of teaching. That's a good question. There's several parts. I mean, I love working with, right now I'm teaching women writers, poetry workshop, and creative writing. So I'm doing both lit and writing at two different levels, although the creative writers are doing, they're writing really, really well. And I think watching young writers come on into their own is really exciting for me. I mean, that never gets old. It gets tiring because I'm getting old, you know, and it's a lot of work. But honestly, that's a sincere response. I really love working with young writers. I mean, you were one. Saw you go through that whole arc and where you are now. I also love teaching literature classes. I mean, I don't think I would say that I like the writing more than literature. They have their own rewards and their own difficulties and their own sort of easy parts. So I like students. I mean, I think all of us would say that. What's your favorite part of teaching? We would probably say students. I mean, that sounds like a, you know.
Well, thank you.
Generic comment, but it's
for
true.
Us being your favorite.
Yeah.
What do you like to do in your processing time between writing poems? What type of tomatoes are those?
What type of tomatoes are they?
No, that's a joke.
Cherry. We're big into cherry tomatoes.
Oh, of course. What do you do, like, in your thinking time, or your processing time between writing?
What do I do? I teach. I have a dog. I'm really boring. I am. I mean, I'm always working on poems or thinking about poems. Or, I mean, I read junk. I've got a stack of junk beside my chair that I read to just, you know, turn my mind off. But I love reading history. I love reading about the sciences. For me, that's really renewing. Going on walks. We love to go to the coast. But just the day-to-day stuff, I think. The normal things. I mean, standing in a doorway and listening to crickets. That sounds ridiculous and kind of pretentious, but I'm totally serious. I mean, ask Vic about all the different robin calls that he notices, right? I mean, in order to know all that, which we were just listening, you know, the other night as well, is that you have to just not be doing things all the time. And I think for me, just as a person, whether I was a writer or not, I like to do those kinds of quiet things where I'm just listening. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. One more and then we'll let you guys go. Jennifer?
I was just wondering, it's really loud. I was just wondering if with your starting to change the form of your poems a little bit recently, if you think that affects your content or vice versa?
That's a good question. You know, in the last couple of years, I've been working a lot more with form. We've been talking about this in the workshop in creative writing. All poems have form. Open form poems have form. Line break stanzas, half rhymes, full rhymes, etc. You know that as a writer. But I have been working, I've really been enjoying working with form. And the Villanelle that I read, if you were listening, those are half rhymes. I mean, I wasn't working with full rhymes very much there. I think it tightens up my writing a lot. Working with the pain poems has really tightened up my writing because every word has to count so much. And I think, I mean, that's a good question for all of us to think about as writers because we want to keep growing. I don't want to keep writing the same poem over and over and over again, even though I will always write those little lyrical poems. That's just part of who I am. But I would say working with form has really been a wonderful sort of extension of that. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here. It's just been a lovely evening, and there's punch, there's cookies out in the foyer, so stick around. There's books for sale, and I don't think we have no worries about selling out. I just don't think that's going to be a problem, but if you want, yeah, I know some of you bought your book for Vic's class. If you want me to sign it sometime before the end of the term, just stop by my office and I'll sign it for you if you want. So you can sell it on eBay and make a lot of money, right? Thank you. Enjoy your weekend.